Where are the movies about COVID? It was absolutely an incredible time. You know, it shows the resilience of people, the resilience of business in a lot of ways, and the adaptability. Certainly, there was a lot of tough situations. There was a lot of people that passed away, a lot of isolation. I think we're still dealing with some things from a schooling and mental health perspective.
Kids, absolutely.
But man, just looking back at it, I think that we kind of just moved on now. And it's like, okay, life has kind of returned to some form of a normalcy. That was a black swan event. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. Higher Learning, the podcast where I'm obsessed with learning about the people who are best at identifying talent, what they see that others don't. So we're going to dive into it with VP level, C-level, founder level executives to dive into what they see differently and what makes them so great at identifying talent. Please make sure to subscribe and rate the podcast very highly. It does a lot for the show. And today, I am so excited to introduce you all to a very special guest. Today, I'm joined by Penelope Pena. She is the VP of Global Talent at World Connect, formerly World Fuel Services. How are you doing, Penelope?
I'm doing pretty well, Oz. How are you?
I'm great. I am so excited for this conversation. When we first met and started talking, you've been in this market for quite a bit of time. You've been at a company that has had some rapid growth over the years. And so I'm really excited to dive in, not just about talent, but also learn about the business a little bit. I want to start there because as a VP of Global Talent, there's a lot that can fit under that remit, right? So help me understand the scope of that role. And then you joined formerly World Fuel about 7 years ago when you joined. I'd also like to understand why you made that decision to come to the company.
Excellent. And I can start with the latter. I think that when I decided to start to join World Fuel, it was because I needed a change. I saw the opportunity of learning. I think that I was too much in my comfort zone. So when I received the call from the recruiter, it was a very attractive and appealing opportunity to me. And looking back, I don't regret anything about it.
Has it been the challenge you hoped it would be? Is it what you thought when you were going in?
That's a very good question. Actually, I remember that when I was interviewed by my boss back then, Jeremiah, he told me one of the things that he reassured me was that I wasn't going to be bored. And years later, I told him that that was an understatement because it's not about being bored. It's about being constantly challenged, and it's the dynamic environment and the constant challenges and changes that we're facing that play that makes this place amazing, at least for me. And then regarding the role, the scope of the role, I started as an HRBP supporting the technology organization. Those were my first 2 years or 3 years in the company. And then I moved to my current position where I oversee a number of verticals in the talent spectrum, including talent management, learning and development, talent acquisition, early careers, and also anything that has to do with employee engagement. That'll be a good description of the scope of the role.
I love that. And so one of the things that really impressed me about you and which I think really differentiates you from other HR executives that I'm familiar with, technology is such a big area of focus for you. And again, that's not always the case in HR. Mm-hmm. I'm interested, how have you looked at technology? Why have you given that so much importance, particularly when it comes to employee experience and productivity, which is still an area that we're still kind of forming and we're seeing what's possible? What kind of innovation is there? And so I'm just interested when you first got there 7 years ago, what it looked like, and then maybe what it looks like now, and maybe what role you played in that.
No, that's a very good question, Oz. And I think that I was very lucky to join the organization, and I did, because it was in the process of pivoting, of changing, of moving to a more leading edge technology, better ways of working. So I have been able to witness firsthand the role that technology had played in the way we work. And I remember when our former COO, Jeff Smith, joined the organization, that he came with a goal in mind, which was to implement, to cascade an agile ways of working here in the organization. He said, folks, this is not so much about software development is not about making or building software faster. It is about the way we work and the way we interact. And oh God, he was completely right, because the role that our collaboration tools play in the way we communicate, in the way our very geographically distributed teams are able to collaborate, to communicate, to engage, that has made a huge difference. Tools such as, I don't know, Zoom, Slack, Teams, Box. I came from a world where I didn't have any of that, and seeing how it makes me personally more effective, more productive, I can engage with my, again, remote teams in a very effective manner. That it's invaluable, I think.
Yeah, and so listen, I gotta ask, because it's 2024 and this is a hot topic. What about artificial intelligence? Like, what? I'd like to know from your personal productivity perspective, is it something you're leveraging in your day-to-day? Are you still kind of learning about the new tools? Where do you stand with that?
Oh, it's a topic that I am extremely passionate about, because it does make a difference at a personal level. I'm not a native English speaker to begin with. You can notice that by my accent, I think, at this point. So I have always struggled with writing, and I like to send decent communications, and it took me a significant amount of time to be able to craft a good email. Now, with the AI tools that we have, and that is a very day-to-day superficial use of the tool, but to me, that actually makes a difference, let alone in terms of analysis. We just we leveraged the tool, for example, when we completed the objective setting for 2024. We had close to 20,000 different records in the system in Workday, but we wanted to know what were the trending topics. Is everybody aligned to the high-level strategic objectives of the organization? In the past, it would have taken us to read through 20,000 records and try to have a very good memory and be able to summarize that information. But what we did with Box AI, it was magnificent, because we just put the document in Box. We asked Box, please tell me, what are the trending topics? And slice it by executive, by region, by segment, etc. And the outcome that we received was extremely polished, on point, and it did it in seconds. And like that, I have a number of examples of how we in HR are leveraging the tool, let alone other business areas where they use it for origination, for pricing, and many different applications and use cases that we have found throughout the organization. I'm not saying that we are advanced by any means. One of the projects that I am more excited currently that my team is driving is precisely we're partnering with IT to increase the AI literacy across the organization, because we want non-IT employees to know what they can do with the tools, to learn how to build better prompts and get the best out of the different tools that we have available in the organization. So we're still in the initial stages, but I think that we're on the right track.
AI is incredible. I think it's incumbent on everybody to understand how to leverage it in your day-to-day. It's an area that I spend a lot of time in, both from a commercialization perspective and then how we use it as an organization. We just actually demoed a internal LLM chatbot called Boz that we're building out here. That's going to be a great resource for our employees in terms of how many days of PTO do I have left? What are the federal holidays we have? You know, what did we do with this client back in 2016?
That's really cool.
And I've also got some really amazing AI people lined up as guests coming up. So I'm going to take you back a little bit now, though. I want to go back to 2020.
Okay.
And really the importance of technology during COVID, especially as people started working from home and working remote. And so whether you were using these video screening or these collaboration tools, if you weren't using them before 2020, you sure as heck were using them post 2020. Otherwise, it was impossible to work. Mm-hmm. I'm just interested, what did you see in terms of the impact of the technology And then, of course, let's tie it back to the business. What did this mean for like company productivity and financial performance? And from what I remember as a very uncertain time going into COVID, that actually for most businesses turned out to in a lot of ways be very, very successful.
We had most of these tools, of the tools that I mentioned before, they were in place the moment we had to send our 5,000 employees to work from home. Thus, I would say that it wasn't only technology, but in particular cloud technology, which enabled our business to maintain its operations as if nothing happened. Sometimes we say, what if we didn't have that? We don't know if we would have been able to react as seamlessly and as fast as we did.
Obviously, it was a very different working class and culture. But if we look back to like the days of, you know, the Great Plague or these other issues where we had some sort of pandemic, I don't know if anybody was working from home. They certainly didn't have the collaboration technology. I'm not sure if you could...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was thinking about the same. And I said, well, there's a reason why a large percentage of the population died back then, because they didn't have the chance, the opportunity to isolate as we did.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that everything that we did was necessary back in COVID, but it's easy to look at it in hindsight. At the moment, I think that companies and countries did the best that they could.
Listen, I am really looking, I just think back to that time and the things that we just accepted as a reality, the things that we adapted to.
It's insane.
I mean, there's got to be some great art coming from this at some point. Like, where are the movies about COVID? Where are absolutely an incredible time that I look back and I'm like, you know, it shows the resilience of people. It shows the resilience of business in a lot of ways and the adaptability. Certainly, there was a lot of, a lot of tough situations. Obviously, there was a lot of people that passed away. There was a lot of isolation. I think we're still dealing with some things from a schooling and mental health perspective.
Kids, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But man, just the looking back at it, I think that we kind of just moved on now. And it's like, okay, life has kind of returned to some form of a normalcy. But that was a black swan event. And that was something that in a lot of ways is going to define our lives, our companies, and who we are. So anyway, sometimes I just sit back and think, man, that 2 to 3 year period, crazy, crazy times. But
they were.
I'm glad to be where we are now, where we're not isolating anymore and we're able to be in person, because as an extrovert, that's something that I needed. And so I was grateful for things start to return to some level of normalcy.
I can imagine.
So you went to the University of Miami. You got your MBA there.
Yeah.
And now you are in Santo Domingo prior to that. Did you grow up in Santo Domingo?
I did, yes.
Okay. So, but you've been in the South Florida market for a long time. So I'm interested. Let's talk about this market, because there's been a lot of companies that have migrated down here. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some that have picked up and actually moved back to different areas. But there's still a lot of migration and business, I think, coming to this area. I'm interested if somebody was listening to this nationally and they wanted to know a little bit about the South Florida market, what do you think are some of the strengths of the market? And then what do you think are some of the areas of opportunity? And if you want to focus on HR, technology, that's fine by me. I'm just interested to get your general kind of feelings on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like a local already, by the way, because I've been here in South Florida for 23 years now. So I tend to
say... You're a native.
Yeah,
that makes you a native, not a local.
Absolutely, absolutely. With the number of tourists and people that are here for just a short term, I think that that I count as a native for sure.
Sure.
So I think it's an amazing market. And I also think that one of the positive effects of COVID in South Florida was the migration of very talented people that in the past didn't consider South Florida as an option to make it their residence. We saw an influx of technical talent. And by the way, what the statistics say is that, if I recall correctly, that the technical talent between 2018 and 2023 in South Florida increased in more than 14%. I recall that back in 2017, hiring for certain type of skills in this market was a headache. And we had to look for very creative ways to fill that gap. I feel that today it's easier because of what I just mentioned. Some of the things that make South Florida attractive, and it's stating the obvious, right, is the weather. And people see this as a place where they would like to spend their most of the year. because you don't have to deal with the snow. But yes, you have to deal with the hurricanes, some years more than others, just recently. But the weather is a great factor. Then also how centric the geography, the geographic position of South Florida, how easy is it to get from here to other places in the world, the many connections that we have from Miami International Airport to any continent. For those companies that have operations in South America, it's a very strategic location. I would say that there are many factors that make it attractive. Some people, of course, they think that kind of joking and kind of serious, that they walk here in the street and they will see Tom Brady and Messi in every corner. That's not the reality. But if that helps to attract people, then I'm okay with that. But the downside to what this growth that we have experiencing and been on the spotlight for the past, 4 to 5 years, is that the cost of living has increased significantly. So for younger families, it's not necessarily affordable to afford the house or to pay the rent. So that's part of the challenges that we're facing now, how to be able to attract people and make sure that the ones that move are able to stay here in the face of this increased cost of living.
Sure. And so, you know, somebody who spent a lot of time in this market myself, I've been here since 2005 now, opened the business here back in 2011. Listen, the growth, to your point, has been really, really great, particularly to your point during the pandemic when we saw a lot of migration from places like Chicago and New York and other big metropolitan hubs. I think if I'm looking at some of the downsides, I don't think that there's necessarily, no offense to all my UF friends out there, but like, I don't necessarily know there's the academic institutions here that filter in a lot of the early and career talent like you see in the Northeast or the Midwest or even on the West Coast to a certain degree. Certainly, I think the fact that like the amount of Fortune 500 companies here, when you compare it to what I would think is kind of a comparable city in Atlanta, they, I think, triple or quadruple us in terms of those types of businesses.
Yes.
Although I think that's improving. I think that's getting better. We've seen companies like Blackstone and Millennium come down here, Citadel. And start to really build out their business here, right? So I think that's hopefully changing for the better. There's no state income tax. The weather's pretty good, minus the hurricanes, to your point. Mm-hmm. What I find is that there's a lot of consultants, right, especially from a technical perspective, that live here and end up being road warriors and doing traveling to other places as they need to or work remotely. So there's a little bit of an undercurrent of unseen talent out there that's really, really important. One of the things that, you know, I'd say between 2012 and 2018, our company relocated close to 300 individuals and their families to the South Florida market from places like Chicago, New York, Toronto, Los Angeles, for certain companies that we were supporting and doing outsourced work for. And if you think about that, that's such an impact on our economy, right? I would think the vast majority of those people have stayed in this market, have built, you know, have had families in this market and have gone to work on at other jobs at other companies in this market. And so I agree with you, this continued migration south, there's a lot to love about this community, but I think there's so much more upside from a tech startup perspective, from an innovation perspective, and from an overall business perspective. So hopefully the best is yet to come. Quickly, for companies that maybe don't have a really strong, you know, relocation strategy, what can they do internally as an organization to kind of make up for some of these talent gaps that you might find more of in, say, Chicago, New York, or some of those other big cities?
Well, I can speak from what we did when we were facing that challenge, and particularly in technology. Back then, we were extremely reliable on lateral hires or on sponsored candidates. We had to sponsor their H-1B visa, but that was not sustainable or scalable. So we started an early careers program that has proven to be a very effective way of creating a sustained, stable pipeline of talent that has many different benefits, including the ability to shape those employees in a way that is aligned to your organization. When you get someone that is right of school, you have that ability to influence the way they see work, their work habits, their work their work ethic. So it's been a very effective mechanism for us. And I can tell you that at the beginning, we had to sell the idea to senior leaders in the organization. We had to convince them to give up on bringing what we call the SME, the subject matter expert in cloud, for example, and instead hire this recent graduate from Florida University or University of Florida with a major in computer science. In time, now they're the ones like in line begging for those kids because they're hungry to learn. They have the passion, the dedication. It's been an amazing story, an amazing success story for us. So that is not the only solution, but to us, investing on early careers has truly made a difference.
I love that. There's HR leaders all across South Florida pulling over the car, writing down notes. This is some competitive intelligence for them. That is some great insight and super actionable. I think if more companies did that and invested in early and career talent and developed them, you know, like to your point, it saves you money from an overall going out and having to bring in that expert all the time. And when you build that loyalty, when you've invested in somebody, you typically get longer tenure as well. So mm-hmm. I think that's incredible advice.
Now, listen, regarding tenure, just to interrupt you there, I wanted to add that you also need to expect some attrition because remember, now you're hiring Gen Zers and what they offer you is what I call a transactional loyalty. It's not, I'm Gen X or Gen X, Gen Y.
I'm Gen X. I am Gen X. I think that's before a millennial.
Before a millennial, exactly. Yes. So I'm Gen X. And the way I saw, the way I see my relationship with my employers is very different because I seek for long-term relationships. In my previous company, I worked for 14 years and now we've been 7 here. I've had like, I don't know, 3 employers in my entire career. Whereas you, the Gen Z, it's not that they are not loyal, because I don't think it's a fair description. It's just that it's more transactional. They're with you until they feel that they're getting something out of the relationship. Whereas we, as Gen X, we were more altruistic, let's say, and we're expecting or demanding less from the employer. So it's also to keep that in mind and don't expect that they're going to be, all of them are going to be with you for 10, 15 years because that is not the case anymore.
Yeah, Gen Z, a little bit of what have you done for me lately? And let's be honest, if we're looking at Gen X, there's some more loyalty there. But think about baby boomers where like they worked at one place for 40 years and they got the gold Rolex at their retirement party. So it's maybe been something that we've seen incrementally change and maybe regress over time. And maybe it's a good thing. Maybe getting different skills and being in different places. And also it makes the employer have to build a value proposition and continue to build an environment where people want to stay, where it makes sense to stay, and they feel like they're continually investing. So I agree with you. Go in with your eyes wide open. But I also think the onus is on us as organizations to create places where more often than not, we can keep the people that we invest in.
Absolutely.
We got to talk talent because that's what pays the bills here at the old Higher Learning Podcast.
Yep.
If I had to ask you a core hiring philosophy for yourself, what would it be?
What would it be? When it comes to hiring, I think that I focus on three main things. Outcomes, okay. Authenticity, and a business mindset. And I'll explain myself briefly. With outcomes, I mean I need the tangible proof that the person has the skills and the competencies required to succeed in the role. I think that there's a say there from, I think it was Thomas Edison that said it. I heard it the other day. Vision without execution is hallucination. So I need to see that ability of the person to execute, to do the work that they say that they can do. And I need the tangible evidence of that work. Then the authenticity piece is crucial for us. And it's very hard to measure in an interview, to be fair with you, because when you're interviewing someone, they're selling themselves. They're trying to impress you. But I think that I am able to see beyond that because I care about people that care about their craft, that are passionate about their craft, and that are less concerned with prestige and titles and levels, and more concerned about learning and growing and getting something out of the company, don't get me wrong, but also enjoying the process of collaborating in A-class team in a high quality environment. And then the last one is the business mindset. And this is something that I pay a lot of attention to, because in order for anyone to be able to contribute to the organization, you need to understand how the business is run, how the company makes money, and how your role contributes to the success of the organization. So I tend to look for someone that it's not only able to understand the business, but also that has the willingness to invest the time, because in some companies, for example, as ours, it doesn't happen from one day to the other. There has to be some level of intentionality and dedication in order for you to truly understand how our business is run.
Ability without willingness is just wasted potential.
Waste of potential, exactly.
You know, listen, you said Thomas Edison had a great quote. I had to try to one-up him right there. So what about a go-to question? Do you have a favorite question that you like to ask in interviews?
I don't like to be too scripted in interviews. I try to make it more of a conversation, because when you are too scripted, you're probably asking the questions that the candidate is expecting you to ask. So there is less spontaneity. And I think that what you get is are very rehearsed responses. But there is a question that I always ask at the beginning, and maybe I'm giving away too much, and it's, tell me about yourself. That is very broad, and at the end, I'm not asking anything, but it gives me a lot of insights on how the person thinks. It gives me information about that individual's judgment, because whatever you decide to tell me in the first 5-10 minutes of the conversation is something that you think it's relevant, that it's important. So that gives me some insights, an idea of how the person processes information and what the person considers important or not.
I really like that. What about a memorable interview? Do you have any interview when I ask you about a memorable one? Good, bad, you could have been interviewing, you were interviewing somebody. Any come to mind?
Any that come to mind? Well, I don't think it's a particular one. What I really, really enjoy interviewing early grads, seniors and juniors at the college level. Because from a senior person, you have some expectations. And I think that typically it's the opposite. It's not that I am impressed, because I'm expected to impress when I'm interviewing for an executive role. But many times I am disappointed with the interviews. With the recent grads, the dynamic is different. And I can tell you that many times I have been truly impressed and amazed by the questions, by the responses that I get from these kids, the experiences that they have been through. These kids, they have traveled the world already during their 20s. The passion, the dedication, how intelligent they are, the level of curiosity, all of those are things that I'm truly passionate about. So I really enjoy having these conversations with early grads.
I love it. When I ask you to think about the best hire you've ever made, does somebody come to mind, or does a situation come to mind when you think of the best hire you've ever made?
The best hire that I've ever, I think I hire a lot of good people, actually.
I hope so. There's a lot to choose from, right?
Yes. But yeah, I can definitely think of an excellent hire, and it's currently an
You don't executive. Have to name any names, but tell me what the interview was like, and did you know right away that they were they're going to be as excellent as they ended up being?
Oh, yes. And it's because of what I just told you. I start with, tell me about yourself. And when I get a straightforward answer with the relevant stuff, with things that talk about the persons, it's not only about selling their technical expertise, but telling you what their values are and that they're ready and committed to do the job. I think that particular person, I can recall, checked all of those boxes very early in the interview process. And the results, the outcomes have proven us that we were right when we chose him. is a successful, very admired leader in the organization that has been able to influence beyond his immediate area, that has this impressive ability to form strong teams, has a very good nose for talent. Even if I'm hiring for a role in my team, many times I ask him, could you take a look at this person? Because I know that he has the right criteria. He knows what good looks like and has this ability to influence the rest of the people around him to work together and somehow think like him. So that was a very good one.
There's like 15 guys listening to this podcast right now that you've hired. They're like, yeah, she's talking about me. Exactly. I love what you did there. Little bit of mystery. And now anybody comes up and asks you, like, yes, I was definitely referring to you.
To you.
last hiring question. We all get it wrong. And sometimes we can identify themes when we've gotten it wrong. When you get it wrong, is there anything you can look back on and then say, dang it, I wish I would have done this differently?
Oh, yes. Yes. And one particular example comes to mind. And I will summarize it the following way. I think that I allowed the shiny objects to distract me in the interview process. And in this particular case, the two shiny objects were, the first one was the company, the previous employer of that person, because sometimes we tend to make the mistake of making some assumptions there. Oh, this person worked for this reputable brand, for this excellent company, so he or she must be very good. And that's regretfully not necessarily the case. So I allowed that to somehow impair my judgment. And then the other one was that I also let the person's excellent, superior speaking skills to convince me that that person had good communication skills. And I should have known better. When I was in training and development in the past, I used to teach effective communication skills. And I know that good communication is not only about speaking eloquently, but also about active listening and validating the comprehension, etc. And I didn't validate any of that during the conversation. I ended up hiring the person, and then I paid the consequences of letting those things to distract me during the interviewing process. So
I think it's a great way to call it, cover it off with the shiny objects. The sooner we as people realize that in any group of anything there's bad and good, the better off we're going to be. There's smart people that went to Harvard. There's not very smart people that went to Harvard.
Exactly.
There's good Republicans and bad Republicans, good Democrats and bad Democrats. People that worked at Amazon, not all of them are amazing, or at least they're not a fit for your organization. And so, yes, I think sometimes that we can use these heuristics when we see, oh, they did this or they did that. That must mean something. And by and large, that's usually not the case. You usually have to keep digging. So yep. I think that's a great call.
I learned it the hard way.
I'm sure you're not the only person that's hired that person and regretted it. So, you know, if you can speak and you got good brands on your resume, unfortunately, that's going to get you a lot of opportunities. So, but eventually over time, the truth proves out. So I want to ask you quickly, I want to move away from the hiring. I got a couple of things I want to dive into. Is there anything you're working on right now that you're particularly excited about?
Yes. I think I mentioned it before, the AI learning program, where we're partnering with each organization, again, to increase AI literacy across our non-IT folks. So what we're doing is we work on a learning path, providing simple, easy to digest information, training or learning tools, learning resources to all of our non-IT population. And simple stuff. It's small or short courses on prompt engineering, how you should ask Copilot about something in order to get a good response. And also some foundational things. What is Gen AI? Because people talk a lot about it, but not necessarily everybody understands. And the GPT, what is GPT? Many people don't know that it's a generative pre-trained transformer. I think that's the correct description. Definition.
Super important word. Let's go through some speed round real quickly because I want to make sure that we get to it. Any books that you'd recommend for our listeners?
Any books that I recommend for your listeners? There's one. The title is a little bit provocative, and it's called "Surrounded by Idiots," but it's not. Okay. It's not what it seems. It just divides people, personalities using colors: the reds, the blues, the yellows, and the greens, and teaches you, gives you some techniques on how to deal with each one of these different personality groups and how to manage. If you're a leader and you have a blue and a red in your team, which are supposed to be opposites, how do you handle those interactions? How do you handle this type of personalities? So
I love that.
That is one.
Good book, Surrounded by Idiots. I will have to pick that up. I do not have that one. I have not read that one. What about, I'm a big foodie, what's your favorite Dominican cuisine?
Can you ask me about international cuisine? Because I don't like Dominican food. I'm so sorry.
Okay. I'm so glad you said that. So we're going to go in a completely different direction. Here's what we're going to do.
Okay.
I want you to rank, because this is such an international city with so many different Latin American and Central American cuisines.
Okay.
I want you to rank your top three Latin America and Central American cuisines in order. What's your favorite?
At the top, but far, it's Peruvian.
I think it's the most
diverse, creative, delicious.
Great seafood, fresh from the sea, right?
Yes. And the spices. They have very particular spices that they use in Peruvian cuisine. Then I would say Argentinian.
Okay.
They have a very strong Italian influence, as everybody knows. So I can tell you that I've tried lots of pastas in Argentina that are better than pastas that I've tasted in Italy. So that's
these are the takes that people come to this podcast for. Better pasta in Argentina than Italy.
Better pasta. Well, I don't know. Italian people will probably want to kill me, but Argentinians will love me after that. for sure. And then I don't think I have a third favorite, but maybe
Cuban, Brazilian. I'll allow you to say Mexican.
I would like to say Chile. They have
Chile.
Exactly. In Chile, they have, it's not necessarily that they have a specific type of a cuisine that will differentiate Chileans, like, for example, Peruvian, but they do have amazing restaurants in Chile and very good chefs that are constantly exploring and creating new things. So that'll be the first
one. I think they have a lot of different types of topography, and it's all coastal. So you're going to, again, get great seafood, but you're going to go further south, and it's going to get a bit colder. North, it's going to be a bit warmer.
Exactly.
I love that answer. So Peruvian, Argentinian, and then Chilean food. Okay, that's great advice. Last question, and then I'll let you go.
Okay.
If you had to give one bit of advice to your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then but that you know now, what would it be?
What would it be? That's a simple one, because I always reflect on these, and it's don't burn bridges. I was a very transactional person. I was a perfectionist while I was in school. I wanted to be at the top place, and then the same thing when I went to college, and then the same thing when I graduated and had my first job. So to me, it was always about the outcome and not so much about the relationships, until someone very, very wise told me, she said it in Spanish, so I'm going to try to translate it, that more flies fall in honey than in vinegar. And she meant that I was being vinegar at that point, because I was so focused on getting my results, on getting the recognition, that I wasn't caring enough about the relationships that I was building along the way. I'm thankful that I was able to learn from that. And I can tell you that I don't think that I would be where I am right now if it wasn't for that particular advice. And I'm also grateful that I heard it when I was 26, 27. But I would have loved to hear it when I was 20 or 21, because those were like a couple of years where I don't think that people have the best experiences with me.
You haven't gone through and matured in certain ways. And listen, it is great advice. Don't burn bridges. From my account, the only bridges we've burned in this podcast are brand name companies, Italians, and Gen Z. Outside of that, we did an amazing job of making everybody happy. Penelope, it's been so amazing. I'm so appreciative of you coming on. Thanks a lot. I look forward to further conversations with you. I hope everybody enjoys this episode. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Charles. You have a very good day.
Thank you, Penelope.
Bye-bye.